Clause 66(1) provides that the processing of personal information of a data subject for the purposes of direct marketing by means of automatic calling machines, facsimile machines, SMSs, or electronic mail is prohibited unless the data subject has given his or her consent to the processing, or subject to substance to the data subject is a customer of the responsible party. The responsible party, in terms of subclause 2, may only process the personal information of a data subject who is a customer of the responsible party, in terms of subclause 1b, if the responsible party has obtained the contact details of the data subject in the context of a sale of a product or service, or for the purposes of direct marketing of the responsible party's own similar products or services, and if the data subject has been given reasonable opportunity to object free of charge and in a manner which is free of unnecessary formality to such use of these or the electronic details at the time when the information was collected and on the occasion of each communication with the data subject for the purposes of marketing if the data subject has not initially refused such use. And then finally, subclause 3 with regard to unsolicited electronic communications provide that any communication for the purpose of direct marketing must contain details of the identity of the sender or the person on whose behalf the communication has been sent and an address or other contact details to which the recipient may send a request that such communication cease. Clause 67 deals with directories. And clause 67(1) provides that the data subject who is a subscriber to a printed or electronic directory of subscribers available to the public or obtainable through directory inquiry services in which the data subject's personal information is included must be informed free of charge and before the information is included in the directory about the purpose of the directory and about any further uses to which the directory may possibly be put based on search functions embedded in electronic versions of the directory. Subclause 2 provides that a data subject must be given a reasonable opportunity to object free of charge and in a manner free of unnecessary formality to such use of his or her personal information or to request verification, confirmation, or withdrawal of such information if the data subject has not initially refused such use. Subclause 3, with reference to subclauses 1 and 2, indicates that those subclauses do not apply to editions of directories that were produced in printed or offline electronic form prior to the commencement of this section itself. And then finally, subclause 3 provides, 4 provides that if personal information of a data subject who is a subscriber to a fixed or mobile public service have been included in the public subscriber directory in conformity with the information protection principles prior to the commencement of the section itself, the personal information of such subscribers may remain included in the public directory in its printed or electronic versions after having received the information required in terms of subclause 1. Automated decision making, clause 68. Subclause 1 provides that subject to subclause 2, no one may be subject to a decision to which are attached legal consequences for him or her, or which affect him or her to a substantial degree that has been taken solely on the basis of the automated processing of personal information intended to provide a profile of certain aspects of his or her personality or personal habits. Subclause 2 provides that the provisions of subsection 1 do not apply if the decision has been taken in connection with the conclusion or execution of a contract and the request of the the data subject in terms of the contract has been met or appropriate measures have been taken to protect the data subject's legitimate interest, or it is governed by a law or code in which appropriate measures are specified for protecting legitimate interests of data subjects. Subclause 3 provides appropriate measures referred to in subclause 2A, Roman 2, must provide an opportunity for a data subject to make representations about a decision referred to in subclause 1 and require a responsible party to provide a data subject with sufficient information about the underlying logic of the automated processing of the information relating to him or her to enable him or her to make representations in terms of paragraph A. Mr. Chair, I do not know whether there might be certainly a key question.
Thanks, Chair. Just a bit of clarity, because this is something that the general public is very concerned about. What we've read now in 67 and 68, am I correct in the understanding that this will stop companies without prior permission being given, and specifically dealing with telephone companies, be they either your Telcoms, your MTNs, your Vodacoms, from selling your personal information? In other words, they at the moment what they do is they sell directories of telephone numbers off to different marketing companies, and that's why you're getting telephone calls asking you if you want insurance or if you want medical aid and things like that. So am I of the understanding that this particular, these two sections will now prohibit the sale of your telephone numbers, and that only companies to which you have subscribed and signed contracts with will be able to have the use of your information in these regards?
Yes, I think that will in practice mean that. However, one must always remember that if somebody gets your consent to do something, so if when you engage in your contract in the first place, they ask you, will you mind if we send your information to somebody else, and you say yes, or you tick the box that says yes, then it will be possible to do it. So it's not a complete prohibition, but it that is a practical effect, is that it wouldn't be possible anymore.
That includes if you don't permit them to put your number in the directory, as a matter of fact, they don't. Yeah. So I think that is covered for now. But it's only when you give them permission to, like you say, to put your number in the directory, which suggests that you have given approval, even in this context. I think that's what it is.
Yes, but it's also insofar as directories, for instance, like the telephone directory, for instance, is concerned, if you give permission that your name is enclosed in the directory, that means that people can look in the directory and phone you. I mean, then you can't complain about that. But what I think what's happened is that the information in bulk is then sold to different people, and that is not supposed to happen, except if you've actually given permission for them to do that.
Mine is under directly paragraph 1B, subsection 1B, where you say about any further uses to which the directly may possibly be put. Is it possible to take care of that situation? 67. Subsection 1,
my apologies, Chair. I didn't hear the question.
Yes, it says about any further uses to which the director may possibly be put. How strict is this rule? If you have consented to the inclusion to the director, how possible is it to execute that requirement?
I think that is one of the basic information protection principles, is that you have to indicate when you collect the information, what are you going to use it for, and then you're not allowed to use it for anything other than that original purpose. So if you want to use it for something else, say for instance you want to sell it to somebody else later on, then you must indicate that when the information is collected. So it's collected for a specific purpose, say for instance for inclusion in the directory, but you would also like to use that for other purposes other than just including it in the directory. Then that must be stated at the beginning when you collect the information. So the customer must be informed free of charge as before the information is included about any further uses to which the directory may possibly be put based on search functions embedded in the electronic versions or whatever. So they must just, it's all about transparency. They must tell you exactly what they're going to use the information for when they collect it. They can't just collect it and then decide afterwards, okay, let's use it for something else.
Just a positive comment to say that already you've got a good client. The universities, when they register students, they ask whether they can give the student's name to other students. So already you have a client.
Thank you, Chair. Chapter 9 consists of one provision dealing with the transfer of personal information outside the borders of the Republic and provides that the responsible party in the Republic may not transfer personal information about the data subject to a third party.
Yeah. I hear your response. There is what we call in the type of our country, which is the economic system, a need to avoid unnecessary commercial blockages, to allow for a commercial flow. I'm trying to say, for instance, if you give your number to a particular directory, which naturally has got a particular relationship in a particular environment of commerce, I'm not sure how very strict that requirement is in that context. If maybe you have not mentioned some of the areas where that information could land within the area of your commercial operation.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The bottom line is that if like Ananda said, there's not full disclosure when you are requested your permission or when you approach the directory to include your information in the directory, there will be a transgression of one of our information protection principles, and that leaves the individual with a remedy. But strict application, strictly speaking, will depend on whether the individual who feels aggrieved about the transgression of the information protection principle takes the issue further. So to a certain extent, compliance will be motivated or achieved through the assistance of the clients themselves.
Perhaps I should just expand this a little bit more because it's quite important actually in terms, I know people are very interested in this area of the law because it concerns the direct marketing. And what we must just remember is that a distinction should be made by what we call ordinary direct marketing, and that is anything that is not electronic communication. So it's leaflets and any sort of direct marketing, actually also phoning a person if there is actually somebody speaking on the phone and so forth. Those instances are covered by the Act in general, the general principles of the Act. So it is what we call an opt-out position. So you can send the direct marketing information to a person, and then the responsibility is that you must give the person the option to opt out of it. So you must ask the person, are you still happy receiving this? But then the responsibility is on that person to actually opt out of that. Now, that is sort of the general rule in terms of the whole Act, because the whole Act is written in that way, is that you can send the information, but the responsibility is on the consumer to opt out of it. So they must stop this transaction that's taking place. However, in terms of Chapter 8, if it is unsolicited, that means it's a cold contact, what you call a cold contact. So you have nothing to do with that. You're not a customer. you're not a customer, and the responsible party is using electronic communications. And we've included the faxes, SMSs, electronic mail, email, and also automatic calling machines. If they are using that and you are not a customer of them, then they need to get your consent. But they must get your consent in some or other way. So they can still send you one communication and ask, say, I'm selling this or this is my product. Do you want to receive information on this? Then the responsibility stays on the responsible party. So if that person doesn't come back to you, which invariably is the case, because people, even though they hate receiving the direct mail, they don't take the trouble to actually stop. So if they just do nothing, then the responsible party is not allowed to send a second communication. So that's what opt-in means. They ask you for your consent. So in both instances, whether you're a customer or not, you may receive one call or one SMS or whatever to ask your permission. If you do not reply to them or you do nothing, then they're not allowed to send another one. But if in the other case, if you're a customer, then they can send you information until you ask them to stop. That's the difference between the two.
Thank you, Chair. Chapter 9, Transport and Information Flow. Clause 69 provides that the responsible party in the Republic may not transfer personal information about the data subject to a third party in a foreign country unless the recipient of the information is subject to a law binding code of conduct or contract which effectively upholds the principles for reasonable processing of information that are substantially similar to the information protection principles contained in our bill and includes...
Are you still speaking?
I think the chairperson actually
summarized. That's what I thought, which is why I raised my hand. Because there is one question I wanted to ask. The very last sub-clause, doesn't this constitute an escape? They're allowed to go ahead if the transfer is in their view for the benefit of the data subject, and if it were reasonably practical to obtain such consent, the data subject would be likely to give it. Now, we've had a similar example earlier on in the bill. Surely someone could avoid this obligation and simply argue that in their view the data subject would have been likely to give permission, so they just went ahead. Isn't it too wide?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would appear that the ambit of paragraph E may be wide, but I think maybe one should just take into consideration that it might happen once or twice, and there may be companies or responsible parties who may attempt to do so. But I think once you're faced with a data subject who is not satisfied with something like that, and you initiate the enforcement mechanisms, I think that is something that will most probably yes.
I'm concerned about that may in the first sentence of section 69. I think it gives now the responsible party discretion. I wonder if we may not take that may with shall.
Chair, thank you. That's certainly something that we can look at, but we're not really concerned about the draft. The obligation or the prohibition is still there because we've actually got our exclusions contained in paragraph A to E. But the proposal, we can certainly look at the drafting, and I think Mr. Makabeni from the State Law Advisors will also assist us here. If we would like to replace it, we'll most probably not use shall but must. But I'm not concerned, and I don't know whether Mr. Makubeni would like to maybe add something at this stage, but I think the prohibition is clear. The construction does not provide, a discretion to the responsible party.
I think to add to what Inka said about the exceptions here in this and E, they come from the EU directive, but it has been indicated in the EU directive that it should be interpreted restrictively. So you can't just say, oh, well, I'm going to give the person a nice contract and therefore it's being stable or whatever. The person may not want the contract. It must be really where a person is, for instance, ill and not able to give the consent of the transfer of the information. For instance, if you become ill while overseas while traveling or so forth. So it should be interpreted restrictively, the reasonably practicable requirements. And I think if a court ever has to decide on that, or even if a regulator has to decide whether the responsible party has complied with this exception, then they will look at the EU directive and the information supplied with the memorandum with the EU directive.
Chapter 10 deals with the enforcement. Clause 70 deals with the interference with the protection of personal information of the data subject, and this is really where we get to the remedial actions that can be taken by data subjects who are aggrieved by certain actions of responsible parties. Clause 70 provides that for the purposes of this chapter, interference with the protection of personal information of a data subject consists in relation to that data subject of any breach of the information protection principle set out in Chapter 3, non-compliance with Sections 21, 47, 66, 67, 68, or 69, or the breach of the provisions of a code of conduct issued in terms of Section 57. Clause 71 deals with complaints and provides that any person may submit a complaint to the regulators in the prescribed manner and form, alleging interference with the protection of personal information of the data subject, or in terms of Section 61.3, if the data subject is aggrieved by the determination of an adjudicator. Clause 72 deals with the modes of complaint to the regulator and provides that a complaint to the regulator may be made either orally or in writing. The clause then further provides that if the complaint is oral, it must be transformed into writing as soon as possible, and an obligation is placed on the regulator to assist those persons who may not be in a position or able to submit the complaints finally in writing. Clause 73 deals with the investigation by the regulator and provides that the regulator, after receiving a complaint made in terms of Section 71, the regulator must investigate any alleged interference with the protection of personal information of a data subject in a prescribed manner, act where appropriate as a conciliator in relation to any such interference in the prescribed manner, and take such further action as is contemplated in terms of Chapter 10. The regulator may, on its own initiative, commence an investigation under Subsection 1. Clause 74 provides that action on the receipt of a complaint in terms of Section 71, the regulator may investigate the complaint or decide in accordance with Section 75 to take no action on the complaint. But the regulator must, as soon as possible, advise the complainant that the responsible party to whom the complaint relates of the course of action that the regulator proposes to adopt in terms of the clause. Then Clause 75 deals with the power of the regulator to decide to take no action on a complaint. The regulator, after investigating a complaint received in terms of Section 71 may decide to take no action or, as the case may be, require no further action in respect of the complaint, if in the regulator's opinion, paragraphs A to F then deals with the guidance there, and that is with that paragraph A, the length of time that has elapsed between the date when the subject matter of the complaint arose and the date when the complaint was made in such that an investigation of the complaint is no longer practicable or desirable. The subject matter of the complaint is trivial. The complaint is frivolous or vexatious or not made in good faith. The complainant does not desire that action be taken, or as the case may be continued, the complainant does not have sufficient personal interest in the subject matter of the complaint, or in cases where the complainant relates or where the complaint relates to a matter in respect of which a code of conduct is enforced, and the code of conduct makes provision for a complaints procedure that the complainant has failed to pursue or to pursue fully an avenue of redress available under the complaints procedure that it would be reasonable for the complainant to pursue. Subclause 2 provides that notwithstanding the provisions of subclause 1, the regulator may in its discretion decide not to take any further action on a complaint if in the course of the investigation of the complaint it appears to the regulator that, having regard to all the circumstances of the case, any further action is unnecessary or inappropriate. And then finally, subclause 3 provides that in any case where the regulator decides to take no action or no further action on the complaint, the regulator must inform the complainant of that decision and the reasons for it. Clause 76 deals with the referral of a complaint to a regulatory body and provides that... Thank you, Chair. If on receiving a complaint in terms of Section 71, the regulator considers that the complaint relates in whole or in part to a matter that is more properly within the jurisdiction of another regulator body, the regulator must forthwith determine whether the complaint should be dealt with in whole or in part under this Act or then after consultation with the body concerned. Subclause 2 provides that if the regulator determines that the complaint should be dealt with by another body, the regulator must forthwith refer the complaint to that body to be dealt with accordingly and must notify the complainant of the referral. Clause 71 deals with...
I just want to know which other regulators are contemplated, especially if we're going to take the information function away from the Human Rights Commission, what remains, which regulators?
The regulatory bodies first in here, I think one think of, like, for example, your banking councils, your ombuds in... Thank you, Chair. For 77, the pre-investigation proceedings of regulators. Before proceeding to investigate any matter in terms of the chapter, the regulator must, in a prescribed manner, inform the complainant, the data subject to whom the investigation relates, and any person alleged to be aggrieved of the regulator's intention to conduct the investigation and the responsible party to whom the investigation relates of the details of the complaint or, as the case may be, the subject matter of the investigation, and then the right of that responsible party to submit to the regulator within a reasonable period a written response in relation to the complaint or, as the case may be, the subject matter of the investigation. Clause 78 deals with the settlement of complaints. If it appears from a complaint or any written response made in relation to the complaint that it may be possible to secure a settlement between any of the parties concerned, and if appropriate, satisfactory assurance against the repetition of any action that it is the subject matter of the complaint or the doing of further actions of a similar kind by the person concerned, the regulator may then, without investigating the complaint, or as the case may be, investigating the complaint further in a prescribed manner, use its best endeavors to secure such a settlement or assurance. Clause 79 deals...
Sorry if this is a stupid question, but This is all part of the regime of dealing with complaints. Is that correct? Well, why do we have completely separate provision for investigation by the regulator, which flows after a complaint has been lodged, and now we have the pre-investigation? It's not clear to me why do we need these two things. Perhaps there's an obvious answer that I need.
I think, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to ask Ms. Lowe to also assist us here, but I think the thinking is as soon as you have your complaint and your initial response, and it appears to you on a prima facie basis that there's not really a terrible dispute between the parties and it might be something that can be corrected fairly soon, you determine that during your pre-investigation. But if you find that this is a complex matter, on the basis of the initial documentation in front of you, then you would certainly like to take the decision to possibly investigate the matter further.
Close to pre-trial discussions? I think so. Yeah, let's proceed.
Thank you, Jim. Clause 79 deals with the investigating proceedings of the regulator. For the purposes of the investigation of a complaint, the regulator may summon and enforce the appearance of persons before the regulator and compel them to give oral or written evidence on oath and to produce any records, things that the regulator considers necessary to investigate the complaint, administer oaths, receive and accept any evidence and other information, whether on oath, by affidavit or otherwise, that the regulator sees fit, whether or not it is or would be admissible in the court of law, and then at any reasonable time, subject to Section 80, the regulator is also empowered to enter and search any premises occupied by a responsible party, and then converse in private with any person in any premises entered under Section 82, subject to Section 80, and otherwise carry out in those premises any inquiries that the regulator sees fit in terms of Section 80. Section 80 then deals with the issue of warrants and provides that a judge of a high court or a regional magistrate or a magistrate is satisfied by the information on oath supplied by the regulator that there are reasonable grounds for suspecting that the responsible party is interfering with the protection of the personal information of a data subject, or an offence in terms of the act has been or is being committed, and that evidence of the contravention or of the commission of the offence is to be found on any premises specified in the information, that they are within the jurisdiction of that judge or magistrate, he or she may then, subject to subsection 2, grant a warrant to enter and search such premises. Subclause 2 mainly deals with procedural matters with regard to the issuing of that warrant itself. Clause 81 provides us or the judge or magistrate who must issue the warrant with the guidelines or an indication of the requirements for issuing a warrant, and provides that a judge or a magistrate must not issue a warrant under Section 80 unless he or she is satisfied that the regulator has given 7 days' notice in writing to the occupier of the premises in question demanding access to the premises. Either access was demanded at a reasonable hour and was unreasonably refused, or although entry to the premises was granted, the occupier unreasonably refused to comply with a request by any of the regulator's members or officers or staff to permit the member or the officer or member of staff to do anything referred to in 82. And then also that the occupier has, after refusal, been notified by the regulator of the application for the warrant and has had an opportunity of being heard on the question whether a warrant should be issued. However, subclause 2 provides that subsection 1 does not apply if the judge or magistrate is satisfied that the case is one of urgency or that compliance with the subsection would defeat the object of the entry. And then once again, subclause 3 is just the procedural aspect where it requires that copies must be issued together with the original warrant. The execution of warrants mainly provides that a police officer will assist members of the Office of the Regulator to execute the warrant. Subclause 2 provides that a warrant must be issued or executed at a reasonable hour unless it appears that there are reasonable grounds for suspecting that the evidence in question would not be found if it were so executed. Subclause 3 provides that if a person who occupies the premises in respect of which a warrant is issued under Section 80 is present when the warrant is executed, he or she must be shown the warrant and supplied with a copy of it. And if that person is not present, a copy of the warrant must be left at the premises, in a prominent place on the premises. The remainder of the clause mainly deals with issues relating to seizure of certain items and the control over seized items, etc. I don't think I really need at this stage to bore you with the detail there, Mr. Chair. I think this is also fairly in line with existing provisions dealing with the execution of warrants. Clause 83 provides that certain matters are exempt from certain seizures and provides that if the regulator has authorized the processing of personal information in terms of Section 34, that information is not subject to certain seizure empowered by a warrant issued under Section 80. Clause 84 deals with primarily the attorney or lawyer, legal advisor and client exemption and deals with privilege and in short, Mr. Chair, provides that any communications relating to a specific matter is exempt from any seizures, etc. Clause 85.
There is a question. We tease out there and coffee as well as water for those who are speaking. We're on the hot chair. So we need to make sure that their tongues are wet. So we can pick up cups and just come back and continue. Oh, no. There is a comfort break to do with that. I know there are colleagues here who would want to have that. So 5 past 10, 10 past 10, come back.
On behalf of a responsible party, data subject, or any other person, must make an assessment in the manner described of whether an instance of processing of personal information complies with the provisions of the Act. The regulator must make the assessment if it appears to be appropriate, unless where the assessment is made on request, the regulator has not been supplied with such information as it may reasonably require in order to satisfy itself as to the identity of the person making the request and enable it to identify the action in question. The matters to which the regulator may have regard in determining whether it is appropriate to make an assessment include the extent to which the request appears to it to raise a matter of substance, and if the assessment is made on request, any undue delay in making the request, and whether or not the person making the request is entitled to make an application under Principle 8 in respect of a personal information in question. If the regulator has received the request under this section, it must notify the requester whether it has made an assessment as a result of the request and to the extent that it considers appropriate having regard to it, in particular to any exemption from Principle 8 applying in relation to personal information concerned of any view, form, or action taken as a result of the request. Clause 88 provides with information notices, deals with information notices, and provides, among others, that if the regulator has received a request under Section 87 in respect of any processing of personal information, or reasonably requires any information for the purpose of determining whether the responsible party has interfered or is interfering with the personal information of a data subject, the regulator may serve the responsible party with an information notice requiring the responsible party to furnish the regulator within a specified period in a form specified in the notice with an independent auditor's report indicating that the processing is taking place in compliance with the provisions of the Act, or with such information relating to the request or to compliance with the Act as is so specified. That primarily, Mr. Chair, is the gist of Clause 88. The remaining provisions are to a large extent self-explanatory. I don't think we really it's necessary to bore you with the detail, except if you want us to go through them. Clause. Clause 89, parties to be informed of developments during and a result of the investigation. These requirements then, of course, applies to the investigation by the regulator. If an investigation is made following a complaint and the regulator believes that no interference with the protection of personal information of a data subject has taken place and therefore does not serve an enforcement notice, or if an enforcement notice is served in terms of Section 90, served enforcement notice is cancelled in terms of Section 91, or if an appeal is lodged against the enforcement notice for cancellation or variation of the notice in terms of Section 92, or then finally if an appeal against an enforcement notice is allowed, the notice is substituted or the appeal is dismissed in terms of Section 93, the regulator must inform the complainant and the responsible party as soon as reasonably possible in the manner prescribed of any development mentioned in paragraphs A and the result of the investigation. Clause 90 is an important clause or power for the regulator and deals with enforcement notices and provides that if the regulator is satisfied that the responsible party has interfered or is interfering with the protection of personal information of a data subject, the regulator may serve the responsible party with an enforcement notice requiring the responsible party to do either or both of the following reflected in paragraphs A and B, and that is to take specified steps within a period specified in the notice, or to refrain from taking such steps, or to stop processing personal information specified in the notice, or to stop processing personal information for a purpose or in a manner specified in the notice within the period so specified. Subclause 2 provides that an enforcement notice must contain a statement indicating the nature of the interference with the protection of the personal information of a data subject and the reasons for reaching that conclusion, and then also highlight the fact that there is a right of appeal that is conferred in terms of Section 92. Subclause 3 provides that subject to Subsection 4 an enforcement notice may not require any of the provisions of the notice to be complied with before the end of the period within which an appeal may be brought against the notice, and if such an appeal is brought, the notice need not be complied with pending the determination or withdrawal of the appeal. Subclause 4 provides that if the regulator considers that an enforcement notice should be complied with as a matter of urgency, it may include in the notice a statement to that effect and a statement of its reasons for reaching that conclusion, and in that event subsection 3 will not apply. that clause 5 provides that a notice in terms of subsection 4 may not require any of the provisions of the notice to be complied with before the end of the period of 3 days, beginning with the day on which the notice is served. Clause 91 deals with the cancellation of enforcement notices and provides that the responsible party on whom an enforcement notice has been served may, at any time after the expiry of the period during which an appeal may be brought against that notice, apply in writing to the regulator for the cancellation or variation of that notice on the ground that by reason of a change of circumstances or any of the provisions of that notice need not be complied with in order to ensure compliance with the information protection principles. And then finally, if the regulator considers that all or any of the provisions of an enforcement notice need not be complied with in order to ensure compliance with the enforcement protection principle or principles to which it relates, it may cancel or vary the notice by a written notice to the responsible party on whom it was received. Clause 92 deals then with the right of appeal. A responsible party on whom an information or enforcement notice has been served may, within 30 days of receiving the notice, appeal to the High Court, having jurisdiction for the setting aside or variation of the notice. A complainant who has been informed of the result of the investigation in terms of Section 75 or 91 may, within 30 days of receiving the result, appeal to the High Court having jurisdiction against the result. Mr. Chair, I would just like to pause here for a short while and just indicate to you that recently there was a case, and I do not have the full citation, I apologize for that, but we refer to it as the Brimmer case, where the provisions of appeals in terms of Bahia, which also stipulates a 30-day period, were found to be unconstitutional and replaced by the court with a period of, if I remember correctly, 90 days. I'm just mentioning this merely to indicate to you, Mr. Chair, that this provision is primarily based on the time periods that were provided for in terms of Bahia. And since those were affected now by the Brimmer case, we will most probably have to reconsider this. And possibly even we might even request the committee, if we had the opportunity to discuss it internally, whether it wouldn't be appropriate for us to, and the term we usually use, Mr. Chair, to clean up Bahia and just affect the necessary amendment in Bahia by way of the schedule to the bill. So that is something that we will certainly need to report back to on the committee, but maybe just to advise you at this stage that we should possibly flag this for certainly for amendment as far as the periods are concerned. Clause 93 deals with the consideration of appeal. If an appeal under Section 92 of the court considers that the notice against which the appeal is brought is not in accordance with the law, or that the notice involves an exercise of discretion by the regulator that ought to have been exercised differently, the court must allow the appeal and may set aside the notice or substitute such other notice or decision as should have been served or made by the regulator. And then finally, such clause 2 provides that in such an appeal, the court may review any determination of fact on which the notice in question is placed. Clause 94 deals with the civil remedies available to an aggrieved data subject.
Question of clarity on the word consider in 93.1. If in an appeal under Section 92, the court considers, and then it proceeds to set aside to allow the appeal, shouldn't we be using some other word instead of consider? Because when you consider something, it doesn't mean you've decided. If it's fine, shouldn't we be using a word like that instead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll certainly have a look at that. I would just like to make a quick note then. clause 94 deals with civil remedies and provides that a data subject or at the request of a data subject, the regulator may institute a civil action for damages in a court having jurisdiction against a responsible party for breach of any provision of the Act, 13, section 70, whether or not there is intent or negligence on the part of the responsible party. Clause 2 provides with a certain, provides the responsible party with certain defenses in respect of an action for damages. They are listed there. I don't think we really need to highlight them any further. I think they're also fairly clear, Mr. Chair. Sub 3 provides that a court hearing proceedings in terms of subsection 1 may award an amount that is just and equitable, including, and then we have payment of damages as compensation for patrimonial and non-patrimonial loss suffered by the data subject as a result of the breach of the provisions of the Act, and then also our cost orders, etc. Subclause 4 is important. It provides that any amount awarded to the regulator in terms of subsection 3, now that is the case where the regulator then takes on a case on behalf of a data subject, must be dealt with in the following manner. The full amount must be deposited into a specifically designated trust account established by the regulator with an appropriate financial institution. As a first charge against the amount, the regulator may recover all reasonable expenses incurred in bringing proceedings at the request of a data subject in terms of subsection 1 and in administering the distributions made to the data subject in terms of subsection 5, and the balance, if any, must be distributed by the regulator to the data subject at whose request the proceedings were brought. And then sub 5 provides that any amount not distributed within 3 years from the date of the first distribution of payments in terms of subsection 2 accrue to the regulator in the regulator's official capacity, and the distributable balance must be distributed on a pro rata basis to the data subject referred to in subsection 1. Sub 7 provides that a court issuing any order under this section must order it to be published in the Gazette and by such other appropriate public media announcement as the court considers appropriate. Sub 8, any civil action instituted under this section may be withdrawn, abandoned, or compromised, but any agreement or compromise must be made an order of the court. And then sub 9, if civil action has not been instituted, any agreement or settlement, if any, may on application to the court by the regulator after due notice to the other party be made an order of the court and must be published in the Gazette and by such other public media announcement as the court considers appropriate. And then chapter 11.
Before we go to chapter 11, I see in 94.1, it says the data subject may institute a legal civil action for damages in the court, or it can request, the data subject can request the regulator. Under what circumstances would it be appropriate for the data subject to request the regulator instead of instituting the civil proceedings by himself or herself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there are various considerations, but I think the most obvious would be where the data subject may not have the financial resources to institute the action him or herself, and then would request the regulator to assist in bringing the action. I think that would be the most obvious example. There may be instances where one might be on the verge of being able to afford instituting a case, but it might be a difficult case or a very important case, and one would possibly request the regulator to assist in view of his or her experience.
Someone who doesn't believe that this must be paid for.
Mr. Chair, then I think we've got a concern because crime also doesn't pay, so we need to balance the two now. Chapter 11 deals with offences and penalties, and Mr. Chair, I'm really going with your permission to fly through these because I think they're quite obvious. The first one deals with the obstruction of the regulator and provides that any person who hinders or obstructs or unlawfully influences the regulator or any person acting on behalf of or under the direction of the regulator in the performance of the regulator's duties and functions in terms of their act is guilty of an offence. 96 deals with the breach of confidentiality. Any person who contravenes the provisions of Section 47 is guilty of an offence. 47 deals with the duty of confidentiality where a person acts on behalf or under the discretion of the regulator. So there is a duty of confidentiality, and if you breach that confidentiality duty, you will be guilty of an offence. Clause 97 deals with the obstruction of the execution of a warrant and provides that a person who intentionally obstructs a person in the execution of a warrant issued in terms of Section 80 or fails without reasonable excuse to give any person executing such a warrant such assistance as he or she may reasonably require for the execution of the warrant is guilty of an offence. 98 deals with a failure to comply with enforcement and information notices and provides that a responsible party which fails to comply with an enforcement notice served in terms of Section 90 is guilty of an offence. Subclause 2 provides that a responsible party which, in the purported compliance with an information notice, makes a statement knowing it to be false or recklessly makes a statement which is false in a material respect is guilty of an offence. And then clause 99 deals with our penal section, sanctions, and provides that any person convicted of an offence in terms of the act is liable in the case where such person obstructs the regulator to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years. And then in any other case, to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 12 months. Clause 80 deals with the jurisdictional aspect of the Magistrates Court and provides that despite anything to the contrary contained in any other law, a Magistrates Court has jurisdiction to impose any penalty provided for in Section 99. And then, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't like to mislead you at this stage. This is not the end that we have in front of us at this stage. Chapter 12 is merely the precluding provisions of this bill. We also have a schedule to the bill, but I don't think we need to go into too much detail with regard to the schedule. We will try to explain the mechanisms or the mechanics behind it as quickly as possible for you, but I think I don't know whether the Chair would like to allow any questions at this stage before we jump into it.
Sorry, I do have one last one. Under 102, you've decided that the Minister must make regulations, but depending on what we do with the independence of this body, and if we rewrite it in the way which I think we yesterday pretty much agreed we would, then it would be invidious for the Minister to be making regulations. This is a full rulemaking body, and if it is as independent as some of your clauses indicate, it ought in fact to be making its own regulations. So I'm sure we will need to revisit that unless you have a good argument against. And then just lastly, if you think that PAYA should be brought into compliance with the Brummer judgment, then the schedules would be the place to do that too, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Chair. With regard to the last question, we agree. We would like to request the committee to allow us to insert those amendments here in the schedule to the Act. The question of regulations, I would like to address that, but I would like to address that at a later stage with your permission, Mr. Chair, because I will most probably be able to write you a thesis on that, but I'm not going to waste your time. I think one should just maybe take into consideration at this early stage that a always in consultation. That requirement can also be included. And then generally, regulations are always just in support of certain functions, powers, and duties, and we will never be able to encroach on those powers through our regulatory framework.
Mr. Chairman, I just would like to intervene in this point because I feel very strongly about the reform of the regulatory process in South Africa, which is in many respects obsolete. And especially in a field like this, regulations are very technical. Coming out of government, they always trigger the law of unintended consequences. And dealing with this subject matter, terrible things are often done for the best possible intentions. This is a field in which we are protecting freedoms by limiting freedoms. And that's the contradiction. So in other pieces of legislation, for instance, I refer you to the Immigration Act, where there was the same consideration of the regulation actually defining the actual details. In immigration also, God is in the details and the devil is in the details. And so in this regulation, there is a two-stage process in which the minister issues a notice of wanting to regulate, gets comments, issues a draft regulation, gets comments, and then issues the final regulation. So that God stays in the details and the devil gets out of the details. So I think that if we don't go for the regulatory model, which I think would be much more preferable, having a regulatory agency, and whenever there are technical matters, international best practice is to have a regulatory agency rather than a regulatory minister. If we don't go with the regulatory agency or in conjunction with the regulatory agency, let's do go with the notice and comment regulatory regulation-making process.
I think we are not finalizing the issue. It has just been selected. He is coming back before we conclude the matter. We'll debate them. We might have to look at his thesis and the doctor's thesis and see how we proceed them. And the professor. but basically it's not the serious. I think they will come back with whatever. And as we discussed here in this committee, I'm sure members will be allowed to make their input.
Thank you, Chief. Yes, then I suppose I don't need to. Oh, sorry.
Chair, a person aggrieved by the violation of any of the provisions of this act has the right to institute legal proceedings either in the High Court or in the Magistrate Court. How will one know whether the matter should go to the High Court or to the Magistrate Court? Does the act indicate, the bill indicate as well? How do you determine which court is supposed to go to?
The bottom line is, Mr. Chair, that the jurisdiction by the various courts will be most probably determined by the substance of the civil claim itself, the amount claimed, is one of the factors that will be taken into consideration in order to determine jurisdiction.
I think I can just also include the right of appeal, for instance, in Section 92 is to the High Court. But we have indicated that the jurisdiction to impose penalties.
Civil claim, basically, isn't it? So it does that at any court, you go straight to the court that is going to make the final determination.
Yes, sorry, I think we just went a bit wider with our answer, but the substance of the civil claim, the amount claimed, will most probably be the deciding factor. In other words, if you claim an amount above the ordinary jurisdiction of the magistrate's court, you go to the High Court. Thank you, Chair. Clause 103 provides for transitional arrangements and provides that the processing which is taking place on the date when the Act comes into force and does not conform to it must within 1 year of the date be made conform and thereafter be notified to the regulator in terms of Section 17.1. But subclause 2 provides that the 1 year period referred to in subsection 1 may be extended by the minister by noticing the Gazette for a maximum period of 3 years. And then subsection 3 provides that section 56.2 does not apply to processing referred to in section 55, which is taking place on the date of commencement of the Act, or as the case may be, of the legislation, regulations, or codes of conduct applying to such processing. And then finally, our clause 104 provides us with the short title and commencement of the Act, and the subsection 2 provides that different dates of commencement may be determined in respect of different provisions of the Act or in respect of different class or classes of information and bodies. Mr. Chair, then in our schedule, we aim to amend a few existing pieces of legislation. With regard to the proposed amendments at this stage to the Promotion of Access to Information Act, I could possibly indicate at this stage that primarily it is also aimed at transferring the functions of the Human Rights Commission that that commission has in terms of FAHIA to the regulator. And then the remaining amendments to the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act is also aimed at, and of course the National Credit Act, to bring those acts in line where necessary to the to our act or to our bill. I don't think I need to bore you with the detail. I think that is something, Mr. Chair, that we can really go through when we do the clause by clause. Maybe just to note that there are proposed amendments to existing legislation, of which the most notable at this stage possibly is, of course, the yes, Chair. And Chair, that really concludes what we have for you at this stage.
Yes, just one question from me. This last thing that you are mentioning. Obviously, I've got to debate the philosophical thing of it, but what it means to transfer those things from human rights to. We've got to debate that. And so that's one. And two, as we discuss it, how to achieve that. Would that involve constitutional amendments? So those are related things that you are going to have to walk us through when we come to it. For me, that is for now.
Reminds me, and I'm sure you need to do other things, Jack. But it's quite important that we should see the exit report compiled by the outgoing human rights commissioners, and of course none of us were able to attend their farewell function since we were here appointing a new one. But that, no doubt, that exit report will deal with the difficulties they have encountered with the information function, and that might assist us.
Well, I've been informed the party went off very well, which we missed. Farewell party. The farewell party of Brother Colapet and his people, former commissioner. So I take it we are done with the briefing today. And I want to take this opportunity to thank you most sincerely. I think it has been thorough, quite thorough. I'm speaking for the committee. I think I'm happy you have helped us understand the difficult task ahead for us.
Chairman, I really apologize. I don't want to take the debate back, but I just want to engage on a general question for my understanding of the bill. And if this has been discussed, please do rule me out of order, and I will have a private interaction because I was not here yesterday. I wanted to know the rationale for the registration requirement for for the registration requirements of personal information of responsible party with the regulators. And again, I appreciate that this is it's a philosophical approach. I already disclosed my ideological bias, which is libertarian. I'm a libertarian. Everyone has got his own ideological biases.
But basically, I don't think we should go on.
I was wondering whether there is a reason for the registration, rather than creating a system in which rules are set, there is an enforcement mechanism. There are mechanisms for people who are aggrieved to resort. Why should, and I'm asking generally, if there is a reason, why should the responsible party have to register? I just get terribly nervous whenever there is a registration requirement, which then becomes a licensing requirement, which then becomes a fee requirement, an application requirement, and the entire thing. I do it, the mechanism is there, I step over the line, you jump on me. I don't step over the line, leave me alone.
I'll allow the question and answer, and we're not going to discuss it. We are going to debate that issue when we go now into the bill. No, they'll answer now. I've allowed the, I've got to treat members here with, sometimes give them some bit of grace, because I understand press of time and committee. So for that reason, I'll allow the question to stand and the answer to come through, and we can reflect about it. We're having lunch, by the way. City lunch is organized for members. I would hope you, if you're not available, we should book. We should stop the booking. So let's start with the question and answer that.
I think there are three ways in which one can deal with it and which different countries have dealt with it differently. The one is licensing, the other is registration, and the other is notification. Licensing is the strictest one, and that was the way that it used to be done years ago. But most countries have now left that behind. They're not using licensing anymore, because what they found is that the regulator is busy with the licensing requirements all the time. Instead of really looking at whether the information is being protected, they're busy with bureaucratic, licensing requirements. So that's not being used anymore. Registration is a lighter form where you have to register before you're allowed to start your processing. And then the lightest possible process that you can have is notification, and that's actually what we have in this bill. So we're not asking for registration, we're just asking for notification. And we decided to include that, we decided to go for that, because that is the trend now. As I say, it used to be very strict, and they actually realized that it was not a good idea to spend all your resources on that aspect, which is only administrative in nature. So, but we need the notification, because if the regulator doesn't know who is processing information, it's going to be very difficult for the regulator to actually regulate. So it's a question of informing the regulator that you are busy processing information. It's not registration, it's not licensing. And it is needed for the regulator to have a sort of a view of what's going on in the country and who's doing what. And also, insofar as education and communication and all of those things are concerned, if the regulator doesn't have the information as to who to speak to, then it's going to be very difficult for him to comply with his role as educator and informant and so, the person who give information and so forth. But if you do not, the processing is not reliant on the notification. If you do not notify, then it's a problem, and you're going to be in trouble, but it doesn't mean that you can't start processing. You will just be in, you know, the regulator will be able to give you an enforcement notice or whatever. You will be in trouble for not complying with the
are we available for city lunch? I don't know. If members are not there, we shouldn't threaten the kitchen with that. No, it's not true that they no, their numbers will be available here. Please, enjoy yourself at the expense of the committee.
Just one small matter. There used to be a thing called the emotion of desirability. Does that still apply?
Once we've taken submissions and put them on.
Not before. Okay. Mm. All right.
That's strange to me. I'm very new here. I don't know what to do here.
Thank you very much,
members and the department and
that issue that I raised with you earlier, the Criminal Law Amendment Bill, which is a justice bill, and it's the forensics bill that is being done by police at the moment, and it's just a concern of mine that there's no input from this portfolio committee. We should at the very least be conferring with them jointly on that bill. There are huge constitutional implications there, and I just raised it as an issue as to we should find out why, first of all, it is with safety and security, not with this bill, because it falls under the administration of the Minister of Justice. Secondly, we need to be monitoring what's going on there. I know the Department of Justice has an official there. We need to be aware of that, and I just raise it as a matter of concern. Thank you, Chair.
Is it possible for us to write to the speaker? I think that's what we should do. So say we believe the bill belongs here. Somehow got hijacked along the way. And they must advise us on how to deal with it. Now we can then make a copy to the minister, I suppose. I don't know, to the speaker. Copy to the minister, to the speaker. Possible then, yeah. Let's do that. You want to say something?
Okay, just to say that when the bill was referred to that committee, there was a requirement that they should confer with us. But I think the difficulty now is that we have our problem as a committee as well. We've got this business of processing. So the issue is how do we find time to process this bill and the other one at the same time? Because I think our programs, like the two programs on the two bills, are running at the same time. So it's either, as a committee here, we decide that we're going to send maybe one or two members to that committee, or then parties are going to rely on the colleagues serving in the other committee to brief them on what is happening. It's up to members or parties to decide.
No, I understand. Chris, you want to say something?
Sure.
Yeah. No, it's just going to be so difficult for other parties. Unless the DA and C might afford that, but it's going to be very difficult for other parties to participate in that. so what are we going to do? I think sitting here, what we can assign a team to go and represent us there, but even in the course of our processing this, they should occasionally come and report back to allow for other parties that can sit in there, at least to make input sitting here with us primarily. I don't know. But hey, in this matter, it's very difficult.
We have got another member at that committee, but I think it's a good idea maybe to assign a member from the larger parties to go there or to have a briefing that the justice official briefs us as well. We could have a an hour or two briefing on that so that we are aware as well. That's another alternative. Just depending on our program, obviously it's not easy to get to the full groups, but I think your suggestion of having someone from this committee just monitoring and coming back to us, they don't necessarily have to attend every session. There's a lot of public hearings that are now being held, but just that we are up to date with what's going on, because our minister is going to have to enforce that bill. We are going to have to exercise oversight over it. So if we don't know what's been passed there, and there are implications for this privacy bill here. There's biometric, there's a reference to biometric information in our privacy bill that's directly being dealt with now in the forensics bill. So there's a definitely a degree, but I agree with you that our program is such that we're not going to be able to jointly, the ideal would be for the two committees to jointly confer, but we're not going to be able to do that. That bill is very urgent, so I think the fact that they are continuing with it is a necessary, is a good thing, and we need to have maybe some feedback.
Yeah. But if you are saying the other one is very urgent, are you suggesting this one is not that urgent?
No, I think it's
The reason why I'm saying that is because if this is not as urgent as the other one, we might reorganize or consider reorganizing our program for a friend city.
That's for the
difficult to guide. I'm putting it. Yes. Because from you want to say something? Okay, just you want to assist us? You guys can come in and just advise what is our
story. I think this criminal law bill would really be limping if it didn't come to this committee. So I have a strong feeling that whatever we do, we must have insight into it. We must make our input.
From what I know of the program, they're meeting very intensively. So I think they're meeting this week, and then Benani will have to help me. It's not next week, but the week after. I need to check. So they're planning on finishing the bill in quite a short time, but intensively. So they're meeting Mondays to Fridays. So what we could do is we could get the program and then sort of see what we can do around that. Yeah. Also, there are documents available.
The history of the bill was an ad hoc committee was formed in January of this year because it was seen as a very urgent bill. And that ad hoc committee had representatives from the Safe and Security Portfolio Committee and the Justice Portfolio Committee. The idea was to finalize it urgently. It was not done due to various elections and various issues. I was under the presumption that it would then come back to the justice because it's a justice bill. But the police have a very strong implementation role in that bill. So I think that's where the dilemma has come in. But definitely, I agree with my colleague there that it's a criminal law amendment bill. We need to have insight there.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to believe that things ought to be done by the book. Also not to set a wrong precedent, but there are practical difficulties. The book tells us that it is our responsibility. We exercise oversight. We need to formally adopt that bill. So we need to marry the book with the practical consideration, and I just wonder whether it would not be possible for them to do some of the work almost on an agency basis, and then at an advanced stage of finalization to have a joint meeting in which we formally read and process the bill and we report to Parliament from this committee.
I'm trying to think along with that. Now, we would have to handle the difficulty that we would not have had the benefit of hearing the public submissions and the discussion thereafter, because that's part of the legislative process, constitutionally. Could we ask for all of the written public submissions to be copied to us, so we have at least that? and then work on the basis that each of us within our party caucuses confer with our colleagues about the discussions that followed the public submission. So we each get a bigger reading load and we do some discussion with our colleagues, and then perhaps we move to the final.
From what I understand, they had a research unit briefing on the bill yesterday, and today they're having a department. So it's not, they haven't had any public, further public submissions from previous. So it probably wouldn't be too late for us to jump in from that point of view.
Sorry, did you say particularly
thank you
that they are using only the public submissions that went to the ad hoc?
But from what I'm understanding, that they're not using for this public submission. So I'll check. Let me check on that.
Well, whatever the case is, I think let's take this particular format. That is, we confer with our colleagues in there and get whatever documents exist, new or old. Mm-hmm. We get ourselves well informed. But as the bill is about to be concluded, summarized before submission to Parliament, we can then go for a joint sitting.
Yeah.
Is it? So you find the formula. No, they can't. We can push our way through. Okay, that's it. I think it's done. For an announcement.